thought we were just getting the lifeboats off the Titanic here.
Everything's sinking.
The Joint Tax Committee on Taxation, on Tax Credits, sorry, for May 21st, 2015 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for prompt attendance this morning. This morning, we have a public hearing, which will open now, open public hearing on House Bill 2093. Chris is going to introduce, but let me just say that the topic of the bill itself is not really the subject of our conversation. It's this other issue that really is more germane to this committee's responsibilities. Chris, take it away.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In OLIS, under should be under meeting materials, is a document entitled Tax Credit Omnibus Bill 521, and it is effectively an outline of what we suspect will be an amendment for House Bill 2093 that replaces the existing language. And I can go into as much detail or as little as you would like on this document at this point, Mr. Chair. The top block in the document are the tax credits that were scheduled for review this session. And what we have there is the first block of them were allowed to sunset as per the policy committee, or the recommendation was that they be allowed to sunset from the policy committees. And then a number of the bills and the relevant bill numbers and the estimated revenue impacts that we currently have. I included the bill numbers there. Some of those bills are simply the sunset extensions, but a couple of them contain other policy changes. So I added them to this document for reference purposes so that people could understand, at least tie the revenue impacts listed here with the specific bills, because there could be some variation in trying to minimize confusion there. And the second block are tax credit offsets that have been discussed in one corner or another of the building. And then below that, there was the infamous $14 million from the Ways and Means co-chair's target and the difference in the revenue impact between that and the 15-17 biennium. And then below that are another half dozen possible policy adjustments or other policies that may or may not be adopted into the bill and revenue impacts that we have there and their associated bill numbers as they've been discussed this session. And then on the back side of the document is everybody's favorite part of tax credits, and that is the purpose statements. So keeping in line with the intent of the legislature and the committee, I've drafted some language. So it really is draft language for the committee to chew on about purpose statements for each of the tax credits. So please feel free to send me edits or comments on those. And then the bottom part of the second page are potential amendments. And these are some of them are technical issues that arose in policy committees, and some of them are more substantive policy changes. But as I was running around the building keeping track of these tax credits, I was keeping a list of potential amendments to be made. And this is just that list put down here. I don't know that I have every amendment that somebody has expressed concern about or suggested, but just trying to be clear about what's on the list so far, at least my list in terms of keeping track of the bill.
Right. Let me just note that one of the purposes of this hearing, in addition to hearing from the public, is to make certain that we have on our list, Co-Chair Hass and I have on our list, the issues that other members would like to raise. And I realized in my conversation with one of the Revenue Committee members yesterday that I had left off a pretty good-sized one. So I'm hoping that we'll have a general conversation in addition to hearing from the public about the shape that this bill or whether this bill or perhaps some other bill, if we need a different relating clause, might take. My anticipation, I'm not certain about Co-Chair Hass, but my anticipation is that this committee may be quite successful if it produces only one good bill the whole session, if it's the one that encompasses these ideas and perhaps others that people have. So if it's the will of the committee, I'd go ahead and open the public hearing, and call witness, and then let's make certain that we've got everything on our list that we ought to have on our list. Tim Cowan, do you want to come forward? And
he's going to come at the end.
Huh?
He'll come up at the end.
At the end. I see. All right. Well, then we'll go in the other order. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on this list now, or do you want to come after the committee conversation? All right. So let's do that. My suggestion is that if it's not on the list today, it may be more difficult for us to work it later. So let's try to get everything in that we can this morning. Co-Chair Haas.
My hope was today we would just freewheel for a while and have an open discussion with every single member on this committee about what they think of the order, what they think we've left off, whether we could skinny some things up. Some of these are clearly some tax increases within this bill that I know doesn't hit some people the right way. Some don't go far enough. And I would be really interested in hearing from every person in this committee about this not set in stone outline.
Your backside. No, not that. That's probably your PR. The backside of your
video. Chair.
Representative, what's it?
When was this posted?
Wednesday? Wednesday? No. Tuesday.
The bill or this document?
I'm sorry, the document or the bill?
The document, what we're looking at and you're asking us to make a decision on today to be included in there.
No decision. Just
no
talk.
Decisions today.
Okay, but you said that if it wasn't brought up today, it was going to have a hard time getting on there, isn't it?
I think if you have, let me revise that. I think if you have thoughts now about things that we ought to be looking at, please bring them up. I think we have, today is the 21st. I think we have 2, perhaps 3 weeks to finish this. Obviously, the committee can meet at times other than Thursday mornings if we have to. We're not going to set anything in stone today. But the more information we have, the easier it will be for us to craft an amendment that will satisfy the committee and the legislature.
This is online, right?
And it, yes. I hope so, yeah. Representative Vega Peterson.
I'm getting it up, so.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas.
Well, perhaps we could ask Chris to flesh out what we have here on this outline.
Why don't you do that?
Okay.
That would be helpful. And what the tax credit offsets and how far apart we are with the math.
Okay. The first, skipping the first seven, that, as the policy committees recommended those to be allowed to sunset. Starting with the Oregon Life and Health IGA assessment, that is simply the sunset extension, the 6-year extension. That has a minimal revenue impact. And then the Oregon Veterans Home Physician, again, is just the 6-year extension of the sunset, and that has a minimal revenue impact. The Rural Medical Providers Credit, House Bill 2125, has a 2-year extension of the tax credit. The Senate version had the 6-year extension, but the memo that came from the Policy Committee recommended a number of potential changes to the tax credit. And on the House side, it came with just a 2-year extension, and there has been discussion of collecting data to evaluate that tax credit, and there was another bill, a Senate bill, that the number escapes me at the moment, that provide some funding for some data collection that could prove useful in coming years in evaluating that tax credit, as well as overall incentives for providing medical care to rural Oregonians.
May I interrupt for just 1 second on that point? So the question before us is to extend this for 2 years or 6 years?
Well, the question stands. The numbers right there pertain to a 2-year extension.
Okay.
That's why I've listed the bill there, because to try and link the estimates with that particular bill.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, which one are we talking about?
The Rural Medical Providers, House Bill 2125.
2125, right. Okay. Chris. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, that doesn't include any policy changes to it. It's just a 2-year extension.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. The next one, the Working Family Child Independent Care Credit. This is the work that came out of the Human Services and Housing Committee, Rep. Kenny Geyer's committee. And this is the basically the combining of the working family child care and child and dependent care tax credits into one tax credit. As got molded into House Bill 2116. And so the revenue impact there of about $30 million a year is roughly equivalent to a simple six-year extension of each of those two tax credits. There was a revenue impact of a few million dollars by combining the two of them. So basically, the legislature, if you had continued each of those tax credits in their current form for 6 years, it would have cost, by my estimate, just under $30 million a year. By merging them, the cost is up a little bit, a couple or a few million dollars a biennium. And part of that was an increased phase out. The increased cost there was it phased out at higher levels of income, up to 300% FPL, and the whole credit was made refundable immediately, so lower income people could get a slightly larger credit. The Office of Child Care Contributions, this is one of the credits where taxpayers make a contribution to the office and then they get a, I believe it's a 75% credit for this one. Under current law, that those contributions are capped at $500,000, but the contributions eligible for the tax credit are capped at $500,000. Senate Bill 212 had some policy changes as well as an increase in that cap from $500,000 a year to $2.5 million a year. So the revenue impact here reflects that increase from $500,000 a year to $2.5 million a year. So that's
maybe it's not $1 million.
So that one is, there is more to that than the simple six-year extension. Then the next two, the child with a disability and severe disability, these are tax credits where eligible taxpayers get an extra personal exemption credit if the taxpayer, the spouse, has a severe disability or if they have a child with a disability. And these bills are, as they came out of Human Services and Housing, it is a six-year extension, but there is the tax credits are means-tested at $100,000. So income for tax filers with income over $100,000, they would not get this tax credit. So the revenue impact here is a little bit less than the six-year extension. The Public University Venture Development Fund, those two bills are identical. There are a number of policy changes there. It is the six-year extent, or this one is an eight-year extension. It puts it back in with the initial group when these three groups of tax credits were created in 2009. The Public University Venture Development Fund got moved to a different group, so this puts it back with its original group. So there's an eight-year extension, but that's the argument for the eight-year extension. It puts it back in line with tax credits that are more business-oriented, given the nature of that tax credit being the intent of commercializing university R&D. That one does, there are some significant changes there. Under current law, there is it's a three-year credit with no carry-forward. This converts it to a one-year credit with either three- or five-year carry-forward. And this is one where the draft that came out of the committee wasn't exactly what the proponents had intended going in. The intent was to have a contribution cap per taxpayer of $1 million, and at a 60% credit, they could get a $600,000 credit. But the way it came out of the committee is that the credit would be capped at $1 million. This is one of those credits where there's confusion in statute around do the limits pertain to the credit or the contribution that trigger the credit. And so on the back side of this, a couple of the amendments that I have listed there would be changing that limit to $1 million for the contribution, thereby limiting the tax credit to $600,000. And there's also an increase in the program cap. You heard some testimony from the proponents saying that within the next year or two, they were expected to hit the cap. Under current law, the cap is $8.4 million. This would increase it to $15 million in credits. So the language in the drafted bill in 2569 and Senate Bill 44 has a program cap of $25 million in credits. That $25 million cap was intended to be for the contributions, so that the program cap would be $15 million in credits. And this is also a little bit different. This is not an annual cap or a biennial cap. It is a cap that is separate from time. This is a tax credit that, as revenues start to flow in, they repay the state, they repay the general fund. And as they repay the general fund, they buy room under that cap.
That's how it works. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chris. And just on the high line item, this reflects the 70% credit. Is that correct?
Yes.
60.
The 60.
60.
And this is one where the universities did, they were able to get me a history of contributions, and most of the contributions, the largest they got were maybe $100,000 or $200,000. The risk of this revenue impact is with a contribution cap of $1 million and a tax credit of $600,000, what's the likelihood that they could get a very large contribution or two? It opens that door, mm-hmm. and it becomes, in terms of a revenue impact, almost an expected value approach in terms of what I think that estimated revenue impact will be. They can't point to somebody who's waiting to give them $1 million and get that $600,000 tax credit. And historically, most of the largest contributions were a couple $100,000. So that's just I've tried to go with an expected value figure, but that is kind of the risk to that revenue impact is a little bit different from some of the other ones.
Technical question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Boquist.
Going back up so I understand the difference here, Chris, child with disability, child with severe disability. Could you re-explain the two of those, and is there a correlation between the two of those, and are they means tested again?
The child with a disability, each of them is an additional personal exemption tax credit. All taxpayers get a personal exemption credit, and right now it's about $195 per person in the household. So a family of four gets four personal exemption credits.
All right.
If there is a child with a disability, they get an extra, for every child with a disability, they get an extra personal exemption credit. For the severe disability, that pertains not to the child, but to the taxpayer or the taxpayer's spouse. So if the taxpayer or spouse has a severe disability, then they get an extra personal exemption credit.
Mr. Chair?
It means testing on the severe disability?
For both of them, it's at $100,000.
Now that's new, isn't it?
That's part of the proposal you got from the policy committee, and that cap is reflected in those estimates.
So the severe disability is new?
The cap, the means testing is
okay.
New.
Yeah. Representative,
thank you,
Ms.
Mr. Chair. I'm going back down now to the Venture Development Fund. So are those credits, is that personal, corporate, anybody?
It is either.
Okay.
Part of the testimony, or I guess I shouldn't refer to testimony, but it blends whether it's conversations or testimony. Was that they haven't gotten much, by the way, in the way of corporate donations. So by a larger credit, they're hoping to get some larger contributions and get more response from the corporate side.
That's what they do over time.
Right. The good representative here on the right's been eager to speak, I think, haven't you?
Oh.
No, I have one. When we're done talking about the things on here, I had the biomass tax credit that
things
I wanted to,
add.
To make sure.
Yeah, yep. We'll get to them. Yeah.
Yeah, no problem.
Good.
And the last two of the 18 are the IDA contributions and withdrawals. And House Bill 2011 does have some other policy changes in addition to the six-year extension of those two tax credits. Basically, it opens up the potential use of the IDA. It broadens the use of the IDA funds, where they could be contributed to a 529 plan or an IRA or other aspects of home ownership, I think, dealing with mobile homes or manufactured homes, maybe. There might be some other pieces there that I'm missing at the moment. One of the nuances here is there's a cap. In statute, there is no cap to the contribution. There is no program cap or taxpayer cap for this tax credit in statute. However, it has been administered with a contribution cap of $10 million. and that's how housing has administered the program. There was discussion about increasing that cap from $10 million to $15 million, and they would do that gradually over time. Of course, that raises the issue of putting the cap in statute. The estimate here does not modify the cap. It assumes that it would be $10 million.
And does it also refer to the conversation we had about the amount of the credit?
This estimate is still at the 75%. Okay. So there has been conversation of lowering that percentage, and there have also been some conversations of selling the tax credits via auctions.
Mm.
And the auction discussion, you have a number of tax credits where somebody, a taxpayer, makes a contribution to some fund or some entity, and then they get a percentage back. The idea has been floated about converting all of those to an auction with kind of a floor on the tax credit that they would get. Those, as I understand it, those discussions are still in the early stages. And it's a little bit different from the auction. I get, for context, just so we're all on the same page, the state currently has two tax credits that are sold by auction. There's the film and video tax credit, and then there is the renewable energy development program, housing energy. The film and video has an annual cap of $10 million, and the RED program has a biennial cap of $3 million. So the discussion of the tax credit auction is kind of building on those two tax credits.
Okay, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, could you clarify again one of your earlier comments that the $10 million cap is not in statute? It's set by whom? And was, how do they have that authority to set it?
It was, there was a letter, I believe it was, and I might get Senator or Representative mixed up, Senator Westland and Representative Merkley, perhaps. At the time that there was some agreement that the program would be administered with that cap. And at the time, I think when the program initially got started, the cap was $2 or $3 million, and then it was gradual, there was an agreement to increase it to $10 million, and that's how the program has been administered, and the department has been very strict with that. And there was information that they had actually turned down contributions that would have put them above that $10 million cap.
And follow up.
Mm-hmm.
And the Department of Revenue in this case?
This is housing.
Sorry.
Yeah. And this is a credit. It goes through housing, and it's neighborhood partnerships has a significant role in the tax credit as well. But they have stuck to that $10 million cap. Recently, they're starting to hit that cap, and they're expecting to hit it more. So they engage in a dialogue with the legislature about the ability to increase that cap.
I could make a comment. There are strange things you hear each day, but I've never heard of an agency administering a cap based on a letter from a couple of legislators that has no legal effect. That is absolutely incredible.
Some agencies,
IDA.
Some agencies cooperate with what they think legislative intent is more stringently than others. But, of course, your comments are very appropriate. Yeah, Representative Woodson.
I've forgotten. Do the IDA funds come out of what part of the housing? You know, there's all these silos and groups, like 60 different funds that make up the housing. Do you know what it comes out of? I don't remember.
I'm not sure about the budgetary side, but this program, the contributions, a taxpayer makes the contribution to housing. I'm not sure where in housing it's housed. I don't know about the budget side.
Okay. I'm just trying to understand, because there is part of that that also comes out of housing funds.
Correct.
And do we know where that comes out of the housing part of the housing funds?
I can look into that.
Yeah. There was some testimony on that, exactly that point.
Yeah,
I don't remember it either. Yeah.
You want me to jump off the cliff here? Okay, you ready, Mr. Chair? I think we've gone through the list, right? Are we going to go through the bottom ones too?
Well, I think we ought to go through the ones, the others that we've got, and then let's talk about add-ons or changes or whatever. Yeah. You want to go ahead?
Okay. So that was the conversation for the 18 tax credits that were scheduled for sunset. the next group here labeled tax credit offsets. So marching through those, the first one is the RETC modifications. That's House Bill 2447 that was heard in the House Committee the other day. And it modifies the cap, two different caps for the within the RETC, one pertaining to alternative fuel vehicles or infrastructure, and then one relating to other parts of RETC. And there were kind of offsetting components to the cap. The net result of those are the imposition of a cap related to the cost of the devices actually raises $300,000 per year. The bill doesn't modify the sunset, so there's no impact in 19 and the 2019-21 biennium because the tax credit is scheduled to sunset in 2018. So there's a slight revenue increase there. The two-year freeze on the CPI adjustment to the federal tax subtraction. Just to remind the committee, taxpayers are allowed a federal tax subtraction, a subtraction for the amount of federal taxes they paid. That is means tested under current law, as was part of Measure 66. That the cap on the subtraction is indexed to inflation. Currently, the subtraction is around $6,300, and every year it increases, or it has tended to increase by $50 or $100 along with inflation. The idea of the freeze here is that for tax years 2015 and 2016, there would be no increase in that cap. And by not increasing that cap, there is a lower subtraction compared to current law, and that raises about $9 million in the 15-17 biennium. After that point, it would jump back up to where it is under current law. So it's not a permanent reduction. It's a holding steady for 2 years, and then it jumps back to where it is projected to be in current law, beginning with tax year 2017. Conway is, I think everybody's familiar with that. It is the disallowance of tax credits against the corporate minimum tax. And then the fourth item, the early sunset of long-term care insurance, does pertain to one of the 18 credits scheduled for sunset this year. The tax credit is in effect for 2015. So in the 15-17 biennium, the use of that tax credit will occur, or it'll occur for one of the two tax years. So by not extending it, as indicated above, that saves $10 million of that $64 million budget at the beginning of the session. Sunsetting it a year early raises $10 million. And so, and that's that group. Do you want me to keep going or stop at this part of the discussion?
Well, maybe we talk about those in the process of the discussion, the other items. So we have some people who are anxious to get in to talk about this, about the possible policy adjustments, and a couple have occurred to me as we've been talking. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So I just wanted to make sure that this committee had a chance to hear about a biomass tax credit that's currently in the Revenue Committee. So we've already had a couple of public hearings on it on our side, but just in terms of making sure that you're familiar with it. So here is a one-pager that goes into the background of it, and I hope I did enough of everybody. So the biomass tax credit has been in existence since 2007, and it's an incentive to help use some of the biomass that's produced in our state, whether it's woody biomass, manure, food waste, and use it for renewable energy sources. The reason it's actually not up for sunset within this cycle, but it was brought forward by the Department of Energy because they want to implement a pilot program that changes the way that that the program is run and that the tax incentive is used from just using incentives for the biomass feedstock part of it to actually incenting energy production use from the feedstock. And so there are some different changes that are listed in this one pager, including really setting up that pilot program, and also making sure that there's a little more sideboards around how the rates for those different feedstock credits are used, so it gives ODO some ability to adjust those as they're noticing that maybe things aren't used as much or a market has matured enough that they don't need as great an incentive as they might when this bill was passed. Because it's setting up a pilot program where they want to be able to look at The pilot program is interesting because it sets up criteria for applicants into the pilot program that really, and it's that's listed in the bill, but it really looks at a lot of the things that we talk about in terms of what we want to get out of it and making sure that there are good reasons for people to be a part of the program. But in order to have all of the data that we need to see if the pilot's successful, this actually extends the sunset to 2024. It's going to take a little bit for the department to get the pilot up and running, so that will give them time to have the pilot running for 6 years, and it brings this tax credit back in line with the other energy tax credit programs that are in there. But because of the extension, I wanted to make sure that there was a check-in by both this committee and by the energy policy committees in the building. So we've asked in the bill to have LRO do a check and include it in the tax credit review that it does in 2019, as well as the fact that ODO is going to be required on a biennial basis to give a report back to the policy committees on how this is doing. I did want to thank Representative Vence for all his work on this, especially in the woody biomass piece of it. We really worked with a lot of the stakeholders to make sure that we were addressing some of the impacts to their industry on some of the changes to the program that happened in 2011, but are really considering when we're giving these tax credits that there's good policy reasons for that, and so that's actually reflected in some of the change to make sure that we're incenting people to collect woody biomass at a greater level when it comes from forest health improvement projects. Because we had a lot of discussion in the policy committee on the impact on forest fires of having in our state, the cost of those forest fires, and the increased frequency of them. And so this is a way of getting at that issue. And I also want to thank Chris for all his help in getting some of these revenue numbers together. Because this is a pilot and we expect some of the costs to be moved over to the pilot program, I think we're still, Chris, working on the numbers for this latest amendment. Because this, you know, it's not going to have the greatest impact as just the numbers reflected in the bill, because we're already, some of the costs that are already ongoing with this program are there, and so it's just going to be an adjustment on those numbers, whether it's up or down. We expect it to be up a little bit, but we don't have those final numbers for you yet today. So this is something for you to look at, to just know that it's out there, and like I said, we're going to be talking about it more on Tuesday in the Revenue Committee as well.
Senator Boca.
Representative, do we have like a rough guess here? A million up, a million down? Is there some rough estimate? Is this something we should be seriously concerned about other than blessing it later, or?
Yes.
For 1517?
For 1517.
He's asking order of magnitude, I think.
Yeah. It 1517 is a million or two.
Okay.
For 1517.
And later?
There's a following up on Rep. Vega Peterson's comment. It can be 20 million or so by the time we get out a couple biennia. There's a question of how much of the woody biomass moves from one incentive to the pilot program, and that's what I've been talking to the Department of Energy. I ran some numbers that effectively double counted some of those, and so that's why I don't want to share those, because putting it together, and I've had conversations with the relevant parties about that double counting, and I knew there was a potential for double counting there, and I'm trying to modify that to not double count, because generally that's a good idea.
The double counting means your estimate would be too high.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. Others, Representative Benz, I thought you had your hand up, but
I do, Mr. Chair, but it's not on woody biomass. That's not another issue.
I think we're ready to, unless somebody else wants to talk about woody biomass right now, I think we're in list mode right now.
The biomass, but not the woody part.
thank you, Mr. Chair. So I had a fairly basic question about the 14 million Ways and Means co-chairs target. And can you just refresh my memory on the function of that on the Ways and Means side of the ledger?
Going back to the beginning of the session, for frame of reference, the estimated cost of extending all 18 tax credits for 6 years, no policy changes, just a simple extension, would have cost the general fund $64 million for the 15-17 biennium. As I understand the discussion between the revenue chairs and the Ways and Means chairs, $14 million was allocated to be able to spend. So that left a difference of $50 million that needed to come from somewhere to just extend the tax credits. So in many ways, that $14 million was a budget to spend on the tax credits.
Follow up. So the underlying assumption is then that this money would not have been in the budget unless we take action to allow it to come in the door by getting rid of the tax credit. That was the underlying assumption, isn't it?
For the difference, yes.
Well, for the entire
for the
TIM, number
yes.
we start with. And then
yes.
if to the extent that we terminate these tax credits, then we reduce the amount that we think would not come in the door.
Correct.
Yeah. So, again, what I'm trying to get at here is some understanding of the reality of the $14 million, because I think I have great faith in your work, not so much in the activities of people who might or might not utilize these credits, but what I'm getting at is this odd difference between the credits that we see above the line here, which are truly those that we invest in folks that aren't going to be creating necessarily cheese or whatever it is that we're trying to build our economy with. So we have two distinct different types of tax credits. Those, for example, a child with a disability. Those are clearly monies flowing to people with a need, but it's unlikely that the economy is going to generate more income as a result. As compared to, shall we say, woody biomass, energy creation or whatever. So I'm just wondering if the differences in those types of tax credits has been taken into account in how this has been put together. I think I know what the answer is, but I'm just curious.
I think the differences have not been taken into account. It's just that first direct impact on each of the tax credits.
The discussion that I had with the House co-chair suggests to me that they were working on the top level estimations when the co-chairs came up, the Ways and Means co-chairs came up with that number. It's the same kind of number as how much ought to go to the Education Subcommittee to spend, how much to the Natural Resources Subcommittee to spend, and so forth. They're very top first cut on the budget. We haven't had any conversations about that since then. I've suggested to the House co-chair a couple of times that it would be a useful exercise for us to figure out how to write this bill in such a way that the net cost is less than $14 million, which would allow them dollars to spend in the budget. He didn't disagree with that. I have no idea what Senator Hass's conversations might have been with the co-chairs, but if you've had any, it would be useful to hear about them.
Well, I mean, I think that's sort of the idea of the philosophical formation on tax credits, that they get the same scrutiny as appropriations in Ways and Means.
If I may,
what you're suggesting is I'm all aboard.
In that sense, they're treating us as a Ways and Means subcommittee by telling us this is how much you have to spend.
So, Mr. Chair, my purpose in raising the issue is that I believe the $14 million is, I like the word philosophical. That's a very nice word. And so I fear the theory of misplaced concreteness is creeping into this. But fine, we've got these numbers and we're going to work with them. But this brings me to my next question, Chris, and it has to do with the $13.1 million in 15-17, and then it goes to $89.6 million in 17-19. And I just would like to know where on that Ways and Means co-chair exercise, the tale of tax credits, this in 15-17 appears.
I missed that number.
Yeah, they, as I understand, the Ways and Means process is not looking at the 17-19 potential budget.
I'm sorry, 15-17. Right. If you see, there, it says 13.1, but there's no looking back to the number of tax credits that we issued and that are still in play that are affecting this year's budget. Where is it? And did they run some numbers over on their side of the building that take into account those already existent tax credits?
Not explicitly. All of those, the tail of all the credits in play, so to speak, are part of the current law forecast, so that the number that the state economists projected for the 15-17 biennium embeds those tax credits. I mean, we provide information to them on what we think those credits will be. So it's the number that they're using is a net number of the, yeah, the spend on the existing tax credits.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, so the philosophical nature of things gets more clear as we look at the degree of error in that guess made by our folks in bringing us that number. And the reason I raise the issue is because it's interesting as we talk about 0.3 this and 0.2 that and compare it to the foundation upon which we're building these numbers. That's why, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to get terrifically carried away with the details here, because I fear that that which we're basing them upon is not worthy of that type of work. That type of refinement, even though I have the greatest respect for what Chris is doing, and good on him for doing it and putting up with all of our exercise here, but I fear that we're drifting away from the reality of the real numbers that come through the door. And I brought these issues up to express that condition of our conversation.
Now, may I inquire, are you suggesting that maybe one of the things we ought to do is to look at the entire tax credit budget, whether it is part of current revenue or not, or are you simply making an observation that doesn't suggest any action? I'm not sure that I understand.
Thank you. I raise the issue because there's a number of things on this chart that are real.
Yes.
And there's a number of things that aren't, and I don't want to confuse the two. The reality of the tax deduction or tax credit loss is clear. In those that, for example, the Conway, I think that's got a degree of real to it that other parts of this don't. What we ought to have is a rating on each one of these to show how real they are. And then we could say to ourselves, are we apple and orange in it, or are we actually doing appropriate offsets?
Okay, would you give us an example of one that's not real so I can understand the point you're making?
I would suggest the film and video, Mr. Chair, is a good one to start with, because the 7.6 is a function of our assumption that we're not going to get anything back for it. What we're basically saying is, and we haven't taken into account the fact of, that that credit should be adjusted up or down by how much it generates. If we go back up to the ones that we are funding under tax credit policy, we'll find that most of those are perhaps real in the sense that the person receiving the benefit is correctly benefiting by that amount. How much is it costing our budget? There's a question there. We have to look at it. And each one would have to be, because each of these credits depend. For example, if you buy a tax credit, I mean, it gets quite confusing. And the time, Chris is the best one to talk about when it truly impacts the budget, and how many of those adjustments have been taken into account. To bring it down to today's decisions. I just don't want to get too carried away by the details, because I fear that once we peel back all the layers of this onion, it's not as real as I think people would perhaps that this chart would lead us to believe. Real in its impact on our budget.
Could I suggest that I think part of what you're talking about is the artifact of the way we do budgeting. We assume, for example, that an ongoing tax credit that's not on this list, that's just continuing, is a given, and it's built into the revenue impact, and so we can ignore it. We are assuming that first order effects of these budget items, but not second-order effects. We're, for example, on the film and video credit, your example, we're going to spend this money by selling tax credits, which then the funds of which are then used to subsidize Oregon employees in the film and video industry. What we're not counting here is the effect of the additional economic activity caused by that subsidy. And I think that's your point. I think we have two levels of things we have to do and keep in our minds as we do the work, and I really appreciate the comment. The first one is that we really do have to comply with the budget number requirements simply because that's the way the budget appropriations are done. And the Ways and Means Committee process require that they follow that Ways and Means process. And that any secondary effects then are included, by estimation, in the revenue estimate, and not in the budget directly. And so that means we have to carry two sets of things in our minds at all times. One of them is the effect based on the artifact of the way we do budgeting, which this paper contains, and the other is what you're raising. What's the actual effect in the real world of all the secondary influences of these decisions? Now, have I captured what you're talking about, or have I missed it somehow?
Sure. Thank you for that. I think you've done a better job than I in explaining what I was trying to say. But there's another element of it that has to do with some assumptions in the impact taking away the credits on certain of these groups. And by that I mean our assumption is that if we do away with the credit, the money will come through the door. And I'm not sure that in all cases is true. And I'd have to work more closely with Chris on that concept. But for this morning's purposes, it's enough I've raised the issue.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair. And I want to dovetail on both your and Representative Bence's comments, because as I reflect on the exercise that we're purporting to go through here, we're both limiting ourselves, so to speak, to the 2015-17 biennium, recognizing 2017-19, 2019-21, but in reality, if we continue with the exercises we've been doing, we will actually forget completely about 2017-19 because of the comments that Representative Bence brought up. These numbers never reappear, or at least in our experience, have never reappeared for consideration. So on the one hand, we're taking this view that we take care of it now and it's gone for at least 6 years. On the other hand, in some of these very tax credits that we're reviewing, we are making changes that backdate. My understanding is, for example, long-term care, I think that's backdated to 2015, January 2015, changes that we see in RETC, changes that we would see in Conway. So I'm concerned with this approach because on the one hand, it's not comprehensive enough, and on the other hand, it is impossible in my mind to give sufficient scrutiny in an exercise of an omnibus bill. And it is akin, so to speak, to passing an entire budget in one bill, because we're not limiting this to particular policy areas under omnibus bill. So if we take this approach, we're not saying, for example, as the wonderful tax credit report that Chris put together, we're not saying let's address health care tax credits. And then let's take another bill and address economic development tax credits, and let's take another bill and address the Kenny Geyer plan, for example. She has a plan now named after her, so that's always a legislative accomplishment to have that occur. But it doesn't allow us that ability to give sufficient scrutiny, on the other hand. So I think there are some substantial limitations in this. I also look at, I'm comparing the original sunset extension paperwork that Chris put together, the $64 million. Just looking at the bottom lines of this page, this would be considered, I think, by most accounts, a tax increase, because we are talking about a $64 million originally, compared with now $52 million for some of the straight extensions and allowing some sunsets. I think in both the popular mind, and there are some very, very strong legal arguments to be made that the lack of extensions is, in fact, a tax increase in the sunset top-line portion of the omnibus proposal alone. Mm-hmm. Then we continue down to the tax credit offsets, which we see a further revenue increase there, and then some potential additional changes in the policy adjustments. So those just get a whole panoply of issues on the table, and with that I will cease.
Thank you. I'd simply note that that tax increase you refer to based on sunsets occurred in 2009 when the original bill was passed. Senator Rogers, please.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understand a portion of Representative Benz's comments. And are you in some way, in part of your comments, referring to what we would call return on investment?
The concept came up yesterday in a conversation with some folks that came in on the new markets tax credit, and they said this doesn't cost a thing if you follow it through and this and that and the other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we had a conversation about this, but it dawned on me that that was not necessarily being taken into account. And I used the film and video tax credit merely as a, because we don't have the new markets one on the sheet here, to show that, yes, there is a cost, but there is an offsetting increase in our overall economic activity. That was the reason for the incentive to begin with. But it's not taken into account. It's merely a cost. And so lost in the ether is the offset. And so that's the point I'm raising.
Okay. Thank you.
And so should that be taken into account here? Are we incorrectly calling this a cost?
Right.
That is the question.
Right.
And why isn't it being adjusted if indeed it's something other than that?
Thank you.
Senator Hass.
Thank you. I think it's appropriate, Rep. Davis brought this point up, to add in the calculations of what these costs in out years. And in fact, if we did that strategy, we could call it the Davis Plan. But I think as we try to get consensus on what we like or hate in this, and this bill, as we're trying to do that today and then in the coming days and weeks, that's entirely appropriate to say, okay, for example, the child care tax credit, it's $31 million, but in the next one, we'll cap it at $40 million so that it doesn't get out of control on us. Or just say it's only for 2 years because we don't like the way it spikes up in the next 4 or 6 years. And maybe that's a good thing to do in all of these. Say, okay, it's $30 million, but it's going to be capped in the next biennium, or do whatever controls we can to try to prevent that from blowing up, or just go 2 years.
Yeah, I would simply note that for 15-17, we're really dealing with 1 year in most of these.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it doubles for most of them in the next biennium, because then we're dealing with 2 years. Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering if it would be possible to compile a complete and total list of all the tax credits. This kind of goes to what we're talking about, of everything that affects our revenue and expenditures for the entire state. And let's start with the biggest ones first and go down. I think, and with their dates, you know, how far out they go. And that would really help us, I think, to understand, at least me, to understand what we are looking at, because this is, as you've said before, it's just such a tiny part of,
right.
Somebody selected this. This is, I don't know, is this part of the information that you gave to us and had us rank, maybe that was just my caucus, that what we thought were the most important tax credits. Well, anyhow, obviously that was something internal where we're looking at this and deciding what we thought were the most important things to go on. Maybe that's something as a group that we could just would help us to understand an entire list.
I think it's a great idea, and to do it the way you suggest, and also to do it by category, so we have two pieces of paper with the same data on it organized different ways. And of course that would go in OLIS as well, so that other people can look at it. It's sometimes difficult for me because we've been working on this so long that I have a set of that information at least vaguely in my head, and I keep forgetting we have new members who need to be brought up to speed, and I appreciate the request. Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A kind of move the progress, the process forward here and some starting points. But first, I'd like to thank Chris for all the hard work he's done on this and the in-depth analysis for all the members, both Democrat, Republican, House, and Senate, and thank Dr. Warner and the rest of the legislative revenue staff for their work, and their work not on this, but the work in support of the members here that are on the Revenue Committee's and Joint Task. I say that because it is unfortunate this week that the integrity and their competency was questioned on the floor of the Senate in depth. I apologize to them for that. Having said that, I'm going to be more blunt than the good representatives who have law degrees who spoke earlier from my party to my left and to my right, and clearly say that I don't work for Joint Ways and Means, and I don't have any obligation whatsoever to abide by any number that they have put out whatsoever. I think it is a good guide. I think it's prudent for us to try and take it into consideration. I think it's prudent for us to do the best we possibly can in this. But I think in discussions with my colleagues, both Democrat and Republican in the Senate, the sort of consensus that seems to have boiled the top, and then I will talk specifically about discussions on the Republican side of the Senate, is that the rural medical, the working family credit, and the severe disabled credits have never been in question. Maybe how we implement them. The Kinney-Geyer plan is actually a fairly decent, very well thought out plan. Those bunch of tax credits have not ever been in question. The only question I have is that every member on the Democrat and the Republican side of the Senate probably, and I'm not speaking there, I'm just saying my personal opinion, knew we were going to do those. So how a magical $14 million number was flipped on a coin, I have no idea. But let me give you some specifics so everybody can take them away, because we're going to run out of time here. Some of the amendments that you have for potential amendments on the back page that I made mention here, I'm going to make reference to. Working on the tax credit policy list at the top, the rural medical providers, we are discussing and have asked legislative revenue staff to look at, because they're talking about doing an in-depth study of this, maybe doing a series of mileage changes on this, as hypothetically, you know, $2,500 for 10 to 20 miles, $5,000 for 50 to up to 50 miles, so that when 2 years or three, 4 years, when we come back and we have this study that everybody's heard about in this committee before, that we have some more detail to identify how effective it is. In the working family child and tax care credit, you will see on the potential amendment list, we've asked and said, okay, moving the nose forward to where the Kinney-Geyer plan is a very good idea from a policy point of view. The question is can we bring the tail in to 250% of poverty or something along that line? In the Office of Child Care Coordination, I just noted that down based on comments that were today. Child with disability and severe disability, I think we put into the same as the working family. There may be some tweaking based on what was made mention in terms to Chris. Questions have been raised on the individual development account, which are, I think, valid discussions of is it 75, is it 50, could there be changes made there? Moving down into the tax credit and offsets, it was made reference by one of the House members here, various discussions going on. We did, on our side, in the Republican Senate side, had a caucus meeting. We have provided them copies of all these lists that all of us had and asked for rankings. We've made it very clear that if there's something on the list, and I will make mention possible policy adjustments at the bottom, were not on the list, we didn't have it at the time, and said if there's something on here you want to increase or decrease or so on and so forth, bring your vote with it. So therefore, in the tax credit offsets, I'll just go on record, starting at the bottom two. I believe in the Conway decision and in the long-term credit sunset, early sunset, I believe that since I'm the ranking member from my side, that we could muster the votes to do something with the Conway and something with the long-term credit. I'll just be blunt. I have zero votes for the RETC and the two-year freeze and the CPI. I would agree with the good Representative Vega Peterson and with Representative Bentz that some of the policy adjustments down here probably do need some of the viable ones do need some discussion. But I would just point out to you that's sort of the position. We've caucused our caucus. Everything is subject to change. everything is fluid, but that gives you a few ideas for a starting point of discussion of what we're thinking about and what the priorities are. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. And I have to tell you, I appreciate directness. It gives us helpful guidance. Other comments before we spend a couple of minutes on the other possible adjustments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say a couple things. First of all, I think that Representative Benson, some of the follow-up from Representative Davis about basically it's our kind of constant push-pull between static and dynamic modeling, and that's always figuring out how much of, you know, how much dynamic to let into the static so that we can try to be as, I'm not sure what, not realistic term that he used, but on those fronts. And I would also, on that front, I would say, I think the argument about the film credits having a lot of other, even though you give the credit, you are gaining all this other economic activity, I agree with. And in general, I believe that having, looking at that and perhaps even codifying it into what your goals that you want to achieve with these tax credits are in terms of other economic stimulation, development, job development, et cetera. I'm a great believer in that. I've just been thinking about this, and so I wanted to throw it out there as part of this, the idea of the credits where you give a certain amount and then the taxpayer then gets X percent back. And I would just, my gut would be, you know, and it varies up and down. It seems to be as high as 75%. It's lower. That's a conversation we have about, but I would just argue that perhaps, I mean, I would argue for picking 50% as your starting point and having to make arguments about increasing it beyond that, because that is still a significant tax benefit to get 50 cents on the dollar for every contribution, for these contributions that you're making. So across the board, I would just propose that as something for this committee to think about.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to take just a couple minutes and describe some of these possible policy adjustments that are on the list at the bottom. The bottommost one is one that I suspect Senator Boquist would have great difficulty with. It has been, a proposal has been made that would limit the number of dollars that a person could deduct in a year on mortgage interest. The proposal that I've seen would limit it to a mortgage of $800,000 at 4.5%, which I think is $37,500. The pass-through tax credit and eligibility is, I believe, Representative Gomberg's, an adjustment of Representative Gomberg's bill that we've heard in the Revenue Committee. What he proposes is to extend employee benefit to an employer at the bottom end, to part-time seasonal employee situations, and to reduce the top limit on the amount of income that could be taxed in this way from $5 million to $2 million. The effect of that would be to raise the $7 million that he needs for his program, and would allow another $15 million that could be applied against the cost of other tax credits. Representative Barreto has brought to me the idea of including the Wolf Depredation Tax Credit, which is expiring this year. That was Representative Jensen's proposal in 2000. Oh boy, I'm going to in 2009. And so it's sunsetting. It's a small item, and what it does is compensate ranchers for the loss of cattle or sheep to wolves. The film and video credit, I think we're pretty familiar with. The food processor's credit is actually a property tax credit, and it has to do with the purchase of equipment for food processing. The House Revenue Committee is working that bill, and we're trying to figure out how to limit it in such a way that it actually gets to the things that the proponents of the bill indicate they need. the point of including it in this discussion is not that it has any direct effect on this budget, but because it is a tax expenditure, it could go here, and I'm simply worried about having sufficient time to get the adjustments made and get it through both houses, through both committees. Referring it here and including it in this bill, if it becomes ready, simply speeds up the process. And then the electronic vehicles, which is mislabeled, it should be called an alternative fuels vehicles bill, is one that the coalition called Drive Oregon is working on and has been presenting. We've been discussing ways of limiting it. They originally asked for a $15 million tax credit, which I think is pretty rich. They also wanted an unlimited value for vehicles that it would apply to, which I can't imagine the legislature agreeing to that at this point. So both a vehicle value limit for a rebate or an income limit for the purchaser are being considered. So I don't have details on those numbers, but it's something considerably less than $15 million per biennium. So that's the list that on the possible tax adjustments that I have. We've added to that the biomass proposal. What else is there that we could just list in a couple of minutes that we haven't got on here? Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The Representative Bence mentioned the conversation that's been happening around the New Market tax credit.
Ah, New Market, yes.
That might be a
thank you.
Appropriate addition.
All right. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had some discussions in a few committees about the research and development tax credit.
R&D, right.
EITC, just a brilliant idea,
So brilliant, sorry.
I'm trying to remember my own idea.
I have those too.
At-risk and disabled youth employment tax credit.
Right. We've heard that one too.
Yeah, it left me breathless just thinking about it.
And that's one that we did hold a hearing on.
We
did
hold a hearing on that, yes.
In the Revenue Committee.
Yes.
Youth tax credit, right. And it's an employment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tax credit.
Youth
right?
employment tax
Youth
credit.
Employment, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else before we hear from Mr. Cowan?
If we come up with something after this, maybe.
Please get it to Chris and to Senator Hass and me. There are lots of things out there, and of course, it's really easy to hear them early in the session and then not think about them again for a while. So it happens. If not, we'll hear from Tim. No?
Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
Thank you. That takes you off our list. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard? This is, after all, public hearings. Anyone else want to be heard on House Bill 2093? Please. Yes.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, Oregon Law Center, here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee. At the risk of diving into a discussion that is very complex and fluid, I want to say that looking at the top part of the page from the handout that Chris put together, many of these things mirror issues that we have brought before the committee, talking about the Human Services Coalition's positions about allowing certain tax credits to sunset. We'll take this information back to our committee to take a look at it, and we'll look to comment further on it. A couple of things, though, I do want to mention is that I've referred to the revenue forecast as optimism wrapped in pessimism. From the human services and perspective, we applaud the fact that the legislature has agreed to a trigger mechanism for putting 40% of the increase in the revenue forecast into K-12. There's no similar agreement about health and human service issues. And in fact, the co-chairs of Ways and Means are talking about putting greater savings away, which is understandable. It's plausible from a number of perspectives. But that returns us to a $140 million deficit in the Ways and Means Subcommittee. One thing that I would also suggest that you might take a look at, this is a relatively small amount, and philosophically how you feel about working with the co-chair's directives about the $14 million. You could also potentially make a stab at saving additional dollars and returning the $14 million to Ways and Means for consideration for programs and human services, for example. The relatively modest amounts of money return a great benefit to people that are in need. I would just conclude by saying there's a lot here to consider. We have talked about the mortgage interest deduction. It's about $960 million for a biennium. A lot of that is targeted for higher income earners and people with significant resources. So in the main, the Human Services Coalition will be looking at the effects on the people that are low and moderate income by making adjustments to these tax credits that are before you, the ones that are up for sunset, as well as others that you may explore in coming to a decision about a bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Marcia.
Chair Barnhart. Chair Hess and members of the Tax and Revenue Tax Credit Committee. To echo John's remarks, this is the first time that we've had a chance to see this. Mostly we think that the way that you're approaching it is good. A reminder that the reason why it's heavily in the area of human resources is that's the way the cookie crumbles when the tax credit sunsets happened. And so whereas it may not look like we're doing too much in stimulating the economy with tax credits this year, it's because of the way that the dates were assigned, so that you can sort of get your heads around similar tax credits in the same year. And I do agree that it would be really helpful. I've put together a couple of spreadsheets on total tax credits so that you can see them all on one page and you can add them together a little tiny bit, as Representative Whitsitt was suggesting, was looking at everything. It's a daunting task, but it could be done. But I just wanted to remind people that why we are heavy on human services tax credits that do stimulate the economy, because the money that comes back to those people in the form of a tax credit or a refund check goes directly back into the economy, because those are the people who are struggling to keep their head above water, feed their kids, and maintain their homes.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Maybe somebody can help me since I'm new here, but we just passed about to pass a rebalanced budget for OHA DHS, where $30 million in excess funds were being swept back. And so I'm trying to understand, we had apparently had excess funds, that's what that means, right? In DHS, OHA, and they were left over, and now they're back into, this is my understanding, on a bill that's coming up for a floor vote. And so I'm trying to understand how we are saying that we don't have enough money in, you know, like you're saying here, when we have $30 million that was left over and nobody could spend it.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I might, and Representative Whitsitt, I think that's an excellent question. What happens with the rebalance is that it's the rebalance for this biennium, and so money that's left over would revert to the general fund.
Right.
It would become part of the ending balance. And so there's no guarantee that those dollars would go to human service programs. And in fact, again, while it's prudent to think about additional savings, we're concerned about the directive that the co-chairs have under the current conditions about cutting about $140 million out of the co-chair's budget, the governor's budget, for human services and health. So I think that's an excellent comment. In fact, that there were savings during this biennium in health and human services, but they wind up going back to the general fund.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Any other comments from the committee before we close the hearing? Don't see any. All right. Thank you all. I think it's been a great conversation, great discussion this morning. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2093 and adjourn the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Chris, thanks for your work.
Tax credits.